This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. It's about being sensitive to hurting other people's feelings. You worry about that? You worry about hurting other people's feelings? Or you don't consider it at all? Both seem to be a problem. If you're overly worried about it, or you don't even think about it, there seems to be a problem here. Being sensitive to hurting other people's feelings is a good thing, don't you think? Being kind rather than cruel, caring rather than mean, considerate rather than inconsiderate, sensitive rather than insensitive, these are goals that most people of good heart aspire to, don't you? Wouldn't you rather be gracious? It's also the way we want to be treated by others, with care, sensitivity, and consideration. There's one great way of being, but there's another part to it. You know, I mean, it's great to be able to be considerate. There's another part to it. We would also almost all prefer to live an honest life, to be truthful about ourselves, to say what we feel, to let people know who we really are. Now, unfortunately, it's not always easy to be both truthful and at the same time never hurt anybody's feelings. Sometimes the truth hurts. And I'm not talking about the kind of truths that are critical of another person or finding fault with other people, like saying to someone, you know, your breath stinks. Not that kind of truth. I mean, maybe you want to hold that one back if you don't feel like bringing the person down or something. But like telling somebody that they don't look attractive, I mean, that's, or that they handle their lives badly, that's more critical. Not those kind of truths, but the kind of truth about yourself and the way you feel. The truth about the things you like and dislike. Your truth. Do you tell people who you really are? Do you tell people what you care about? For example, just think about it right at the source. How are you with your family? Think about it. How honest can you be with your family? If you want to know the source of all this, there's a good question for you, right? Patty Heckle, if you're listening, or if anybody knows Patty Heckle, go over and tap her on the shoulder and say, "Hey, Patty, welcome to WBAI as one of our new listeners. I'm sure you'll never leave the station again. But let me ask you something. How honest are you with your mother?" Not particularly Patty, but anybody out there. If your mother's alive, or if you think back in memory, how honest could you have been with her? Now, there it is right there. If you told your mother the truth, would you hurt her? Do you believe that if your mom knew the truth about everything about you, about your drives, what about your sexuality? If your mom pictured the way you were in the ravages of your most, you know, stuffed sex, would that shock her? Would you hurt her? Do you protect your mother from knowing the truth about you, or your father, or your mate, your husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, or your children? Do you let people in your family know things about you? And then how about this? Like, if you get worried about money, do you never tell anybody about it, or you never bring your grief to them? Do you let people in your family know how you really feel? Like, take family functions. Do you like family functions? Sometimes they're nice, huh? Real close, intimate family functions. But sometimes they're a bore, or they're tedious, or they're difficult. How many family functions would you rather not go to? And how many feelings would you hurt if you didn't go? How sensitive are you to hurting other people's feelings, and how sensitive should you be? That's what we're going to look at today. Here on WBAI, this is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind, examining some of those things about living and about emotional living. Maybe if we look at it a little closer, you'll find yourself a little happier, a little more grounded, a little more understanding of yourself and other people. We're after love here. It's greedy. You know, we're after a kind of loving which means you tolerate yourself a little better, you tolerate the other people better. You're therefore less harmful, less judgmental, less angry. It's all about understanding. The fear of being truthful for fear of hurting other people's feelings. Think about that. You can't tell them the truth because you'll hurt their feelings. Look at how this world operates. You meet someone, they like you more than you like them. They want to befriend you or date you or do whatever else they want to do to you or you do to them, and they don't share their you don't share their enthusiasm. So what do? Right? So Al calls you up on the phone and says, "Hey, I want to go out with you. I'm looking forward to it. You're my best, you know, da-da-da-da-da." What do? You make excuses. You don't return calls. And why? Mainly because you don't want to hurt his feelings. You don't want to hurt their feelings, so you don't tell them the truth. So you string them along a little bit. You don't mean to string them along, but you string them along because you're not telling them, "I really don't have any interest. I really don't want to do this." I think that's nice of you. I know that's how you think of it, that there's a lot more. I think there's a lot more to it than you think. And that's what we're going to search out here today. We're going to search out about the consequences of truth, about hurting people's feelings. You know, you're listening on WBAI 99.5 FM, and BAI Radio is known for its being probably the most honest radio program around. And its honesty hurts many feelings because there's a lot of opinions on this station. People say things that make other people angry. That's the beauty of it. Not getting the people angry, but because people are kind of telling the truth. Well, that's why most of you like this radio program, because of the fact that they don't mind offending. And that's what it takes to deliver the truth about what's happening out there. So what about you? Do you hold back the truth? Which brings us back to today's topic, when being truthful about yourself hurts other people's feelings, and how that reluctance to be honest with especially the people you love, that fear of hurting their feelings, can affect you in many ways. I'm not saying you should be honest. I'm saying you should understand what it is to not be honest. Sometimes I think honesty is overrated. You know? Sometimes I think honesty is like put as one of these great things on a pinnacle. You must be honest with me or else. But look, there are people out there who intimidate people so much that if you intimidate somebody with so intensely, they're never going to be honest with you. You know, if you go to someone, if you go to your mate and you say, "Do I look fat?" And you know if your mate says yes, that you're going to go off the wall, do you think your mate's going to tell you the truth? Or do you think if you go to your mate and you say, "Do you find that woman attractive?" And your mate says yes, that you're not going to let him get over it or let her get over it for a long period of time? Do you think they're going to tell you the truth? So dishonesty or lying can very often be the result of somebody just not wanting to get into a mess, trying to avoid a mess. But there's a lot more to it than you think. If you live in a world where you're being not yourself because you don't want to hurt other people's feelings, then you are not yourself, you see? If you're being not yourself, then you are not yourself. If you go to work but you don't show anybody what you feel or you don't show anybody what's going on inside of you, good thing that you're controlling it, it's all right. Yourself may be really screwed up and doesn't belong in a working environment. Maybe yourself or the self that's manifesting at any great moment is not appropriate for a job. But during that time that you're being not yourself, you are not yourself. You think like I'm saying a big deal here, but it is a big deal. Because there's a me, and then there's a not me. See? And I want to spend as little time as possible being the not me. Being the not me, you know? I don't want to be a not me. I want to be me as much as possible. That's a goal. But sometimes I'm a not me. Sometimes people come in and they say, "What do you think?" And I know that if I tell them the truth, that they're going to get hysterical or get overly reactive or they're going to do something offensive, you know? And I barely know them and I don't have an investment and they didn't consult with me and it's just in passing and I'll just kind of, "Oh, it's fine. Let it off." You know, I'll do that. But I try not to do that. And not being yourself is not the ideal way of being. I guess we all know that. In fact, if you're one of the people out there who can't seem to make decisions, or whose decisions are constantly wrong, then you're probably one of those folks who have spent so much time protecting other people from feeling hurt that you developed a not-me self. You develop a self that no longer knows who she or he really is. If you go around being the not me because you're afraid of hurting people all the time, then how do you know what the real you is anymore? You know, after a while it goes blind. After a while, you can't see it. I remember as kids, there used to be a game that they played with cap guns. You know what a cap gun is? You know, cap guns, these little pistols that have these little explosive paper things that you put in it? Cap guns. And what the kids would do is they would shoot the guns at each other, pow, pow, make a little firecracker sounds, and the other kid would lay down dead because, you know, he got shot. And then when the guns weren't around, but if you were in class, they'd aim their finger at people and they'd go, pow, pow. They'd make that sound. And the other person would fall down dead anyway. And the truth of it is, when somebody pointed their finger at you and fired this cap, you know, you could kind of feel it in your chest. You kind of felt that thing happening to you. After a while, your body takes on the condition of feeling it. It becomes real. See, it becomes real. It becomes like it's really happening. After a while, if you live it often enough, it becomes real. So, because it's the root of all indecision, you know, the indecisiveness. The problem is not what decision to make, but who you really are. I mean, a lot of people come to me and they ask if they should get married to somebody. Say, I've got this boyfriend, girlfriend, I just found this person. I want to know if I should hook up with them and make a contract. And then I kind of go through, do you have any idea who you are? And they basically come out with, I have no idea who I am. Well, if you don't know who you am, how are you going to make this decision about this relationship? It doesn't matter what you make. It doesn't matter because the person who's going to make the decision is not here. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. It's a real important thing to consider about the not me's and the me's. Where am I? Where's the not I? So how can someone who doesn't know who they are make a decision? I know a young woman who once came to me for a consultation, her problem, chronic indecisiveness, in this case about getting married. We looked at the marriage idea and it soon became clear that the real confusion was not about her marriage, but about who she really was. She had no idea what she felt. She couldn't feel a thing. She couldn't feel love. She couldn't tell if it was love or not love. She felt some kind of affection, but she couldn't tell what it was because her feelings were shut off. And the reason she felt the pressure to get married in the first place is because her very loving parents were constantly concerned about her future. So they wanted her to make a decision about this. And for years, they have very subtly and very lovingly harped on the subject. But she was beside herself. A good phrase, you know, being beside yourself, I like that, which means being not you, being next to you, you know. You're not in yourself. You're beside yourself. She was one of those children who came from a proper household where the parents seemed all loving and concerned, but the message was clear. They wanted their daughter to grow up in a certain acceptable shape and form, and if she didn't get married, or if, God forbid, she chose an alternative lifestyle, well, maybe it would be okay if she became a nun, you know? Maybe that would be okay, but no other alternative lifestyles. But that was a real story. She spent so much of her time dealing with her fear of hurting her family feelings, that she lost track of who she really was. In fact, every time she saw her mother, it was part of the agenda. The when are you going to put our minds at rest by telling us that you've made your decision agenda? So what are you going to do with your life? So you got to make up things, and you tell them things that you make up. So, as we explored it further, we found out that she hated meeting with her family, but as a good girl, quote unquote, she just played the poor, confused, sick child. And guess what began happening? Instead of telling her parents to get off her back, she started becoming a chronically poor, confused, sick child. She began to think of herself that way. She became that way. Why? Because she didn't want to hurt her parents' feelings. Funny, isn't it, the human mind? It does such incredibly funny things. We invent our illness and we become it. A form of Munchausen. You know what Munchausen by proxy is? Did you ever hear of Munchausen by proxy? It's a disease. It's an interesting disease. It happens. It's known in psychiatry and in medicine both. It's people bring their children into the hospitals to get medical attention for their children's imaginary problems. They create problems for their children to have. And they keep bringing the children in the hospital because they want to be seen as a concerned mother and concerned parent. So they're frequently bringing their child in, and very often they create the illness in the child so they could bring the child to the hospital. They'll feed him something bad and say, see, my child is sick, because they want the attention of being a concerned mother. It's called Munchausen by proxy. Munchausen was this trickster. Funny human mind, huh? Funny. Let's look at this young woman I was speaking about. So what if their daughter didn't get married? So what if she didn't succeed in a way that they would approve of? Maybe she'd have to face the fact. Maybe they'd have to face the fact that maybe they weren't such good parents after all. Maybe they'd have to face the fact that they didn't put up the kind of model that made her want to have this for herself. Or maybe they'd have to face the fact that somehow they missed the fact that this wasn't her sexual orientation at all. And so what? What if they weren't perfect parents? What if they made some mistakes? Help them face the facts. It's not so terrible. They're not perfect parents. What's the big deal? So we set up this system of deception. And once you start in childhood, you continue it to adulthood. The man that comes home from work and parks himself in front of the TV, ignoring his family. What's he doing? Is this who he is, or is this the real him? Of course not. But he's someone who can't be truthful, that's for sure. He's the guy parking himself where he can't be seen. He's not the TV guy. How did all this start, my friends? How do we become the protector of other people's lying to themselves? How do we help other people lie to themselves? I remember a man that once came to me. This is a real rough case. A man came to me and he was very, 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 by all standards of the words, unattractive. I mean, he had everything bad going for him, and then he exaggerated it with his clothing and his choice of hairstyle and everything else about him, and he smelled badly. He never bathed, and he just smelled wrong. And he came into my office, and he consulted with me, and he says, I don't know what's wrong with me. I can't meet people. I know I'm at least as good-looking as everybody else and as attractive as everybody else. My mother tells me so. And I looked at him, and I went, oof. Because I remember the receptionist at the time kind of putting it at a distance, you know, when she saw this man coming in, because he just, everything about him was unattractive. What was the real story? What was my job now? Is my job to tell him, wait a minute, look in the mirror, face reality? No, that's not my job. But my job was to see that he was protecting the illusion that his mother gave him about himself, and by doing so, he was making sure he'd never be unfaithful to his mother. So his mother fed him a line that kept him as her mate. This way no woman would ever go near him. And he kept the line going so he could stay with his mother. They had a great relationship, and that's the way they wanted to keep it. But she did understand that there was something wrong here. She did send him to me for help and was willing to face the fact that this was part of what she had done. Okay. Your mate has a fragile self-image, and you get insanely jealous whenever you find, or she gets, or he gets, insanely jealous whenever you find someone else attractive. What do? You make sure you hide your attractions. What's left? Two people where one person is holding back a natural part of themselves. Your mate is sensitive to criticism in any form, but also wears a perfume or fragrance that you find nauseating. You know, like garlic perfume. Do you tell her or him? Or do you protect them from the reality that they may have chosen badly? Every time you selectively choose to hide a part of yourself because you think you're sparing someone's hurt feelings, you're investing in a non-self. On top of that, every time you hide your real self from someone you supposedly love, you're limiting the degree of intimacy possible. You know, how deep can it get? I hide me, you hide you. Intimacy, you know, such an interesting word. Into me see, intimacy. How can you let them see into you if you hide yourself? But maybe that's the idea. Maybe that's why you do it. Maybe that's why we all do it. Maybe you don't want intimate relationships. Maybe you believe that if somebody really knew you, they wouldn't love you. So you present them a nice outside picture. Maybe you believe on some level that your true self is unlovable, that the only way you can even get a modicum of affection is by creating a false self for someone else to love. Ah, my friends, it's an interesting strategy, but how could it possibly work? If someone loves the false you, then how's the real you ever going to get to feel that love? If someone loves you for being a star, do you get off on that? I mean, does that really work, do you think? No, it doesn't work. Do you think all the movie stars out there who have people falling all over them in love with them, you think they feel loved? Of course not. Nobody knows them. Do you think that love really penetrates? No, you could feel appreciated, but when somebody fanatically loves you without knowing you, how grand do you think that is? So what if you're just known for your clothing? Let's say you're a great sharp dresser, or you're sexy, or you're hot, or you're got the silver tongue, you know, whatever it is that you've got. Whatever it is, your talents, your money. If you get loved for that, do you think you feel loved? Of course not. You don't feel it. Of course it doesn't get through. But maybe that's the best you know of. You know, maybe you don't know of anything better than that. Maybe there is no such thing as feeling loved. You know, feeling loved is such an interesting feeling because if you think about what it's like to feel it on receiving love, it's like letting the feeling in. Well, you see, if as a kid you knew your parents loved you, but you never felt their love, then you don't know what it's like to feel loved. The best you could do is feel loved by observation. I know he buys me Valentine's presents, therefore I know he loves me. I know he's always there for me, therefore he loves me. Therefore he loves me because what I observe tells me what it is, but I don't feel it. Because maybe you're not capable of feeling it. In fact, if you're one of those people who everybody loves, but that love doesn't make a difference in your life, if you're not fed and nurtured by the love, then it's because you've created a false self for them to love. And the real you stays starved for affection. Maybe. That's why so many men feel more nourished by their male friends than by their mates. You know, especially heterosexual men. They have their boyfriends, they have their girlfriends out there and their wives, and that's one form of nurturance. But they know they're hiding things from their mates, you know. But there's a but they get together with their friends where they feel more natural, where they could be themselves, they could be sloppy, and they hang out that way, and they feel more nurturance there. They feel more love there. This must be actually confusing, you know, to Australians because I'm using the word mate and I'm using the word friend as if they're two different things. In Australia, you know, when you say my mate, you mean your friend. But if you're more yourself with your friends than you are with your wife, then do you think you're going to feel more alive, more yourself with your wife or with your friends? Of course with your friends. And why? And when you ask yourself, why do I feel so dead at home? The answer is because you're not there. Even when you're there, you're not there. And what's happened to create this? It's not their fault. It was a mistake on your part. And here are the mistakes. Number one, the biggest mistake everyone makes is that they believe they have a broken or evil part inside them somewhere that they've got to hide. It's a lie, my friends. It's not true. You may have damage, but you're not evil. You're not stupid. You're not bad. People who believe they have a secret, rotten part of themselves are people who had trouble dealing with their anger and resentment as a kid. They were told they were evil for being angry. You know, but it's a lie. You're not evil. That's where all this taking care of other people's emotions come from, you know, childhood. This is Armand DeMille with you, with The Positive Mind. Listen, it's an interesting thing. It's interesting to think about being yourself. Being a little more honest about what you feel. Sometimes it's hard to communicate what you feel. Sometimes just saying what you feel triggers in another person some reaction because you're kind of blaming them for what you feel. That's called magical responsibility. Now, magical responsibility is very important to understand. It's the belief that you have the power to make people feel things. Like you have the absolute power to hurt someone emotionally, and you also have the absolute responsibility to make sure you don't use the power. It's a crazy belief and it comes from sloppy parenting, but let me show it to you how it works. Give an example. A young boy sitting on a floor, crayons in his hand, draws on the wall. What else would you do, right? You got crayons in your hand and there's a wall, may as well draw on the wall. In school, they put up pieces of paper. In preschool, you draw on the wall, so that's what you do. Mom walks in the room and says, look at what you've done. You've given me a headache. Right? And slams the door and goes into her room. Here's this 3-year-old boy, 4-year-old boy, 5-year-old boy, 2-year-old boy. He looks at the wall and he sees that by using this crayon, his mother got sick. And he looks at the crayon and he says, my God, what an instrument. I don't want to make mommy sick. So he throws down his crayons. In many cases, gives up his creativity forever. What many people do. If you find people who've lost creativity, usually someone said, your creativity hurt me. So then he picks up something as he's watched other people do, and he tries to clean it off the wall. He takes a rag or a towel or a piece of paper, and he starts scrunching it on the walls, trying to wipe it off. And his mom comes out of the room and says, oh, now look what you've done. You've only made it worse. Goes back in the room and slams the door. Now he's doomed. Here's the secret. Now, he has the power to give mom a headache, but once he uses that power, he cannot undo it. So now he's got to be really careful about this power because he knows he can make mom get a headache. Now, I know you may think this is far-fetched, but this is what magical responsibility is and magical thinking is. People think, and people talk this way. People say, you made me do this. You made me feel bad. No, I didn't make you feel bad. You felt bad on your own. I may have done something really bad, but it's you that had the bad feeling. It's your feeling. I didn't make it happen. I didn't make you feel guilty. If I said something to you that triggered off this guilt inside of you, then it's your guilt. Well, okay, you can't make me feel things. I can't make you feel things. You can't, I made you love me. Can't do it. You can't make somebody love you. You can't do it. So if that's true, then what are we stuck with, friends? We're stuck with the fact that everybody has their own feelings in reaction to everyone else. But you don't have the power to make people feel things. You only have the power to trigger the feelings that they may have already. If you're a child and you're making noise makes daddy angry, you didn't make him angry. Daddy is angry, with or without you. And your making noises just makes him focus his anger on you. But it's daddy who owns the anger. It's his frailty, not yours, but you're a kid. You believe for the rest of your life you got to be quiet. Because if you don't, your pop's going to get upset or sick or angry, and it's your fault. If your mate is oversensitive, that's his or her issue, not yours. If you do something that results in their feeling bad, that's their issue to deal with, not yours. I mean, of course, if you're doing something like betraying or being dishonest or being wrong or doing things or, you know, breaking promises, of course you have a responsibility. But if you tell your husband that you're exhausted and don't want to work all the time to support him, and you're afraid to tell him because you don't want him to feel inadequate, forget it. Bring some reality to the table. Maybe holding back the truth is what perpetuates the illness. How about faking orgasms? How's that one? How's that for the best there is, right? To make him or her feel better about themselves while you lay there feeling nothing, how much more distance can you create? Just think about it. You make believe you have an orgasm so that your mate will not feel inadequate sexually. Oh my gosh. I mean, maybe they are inadequate, you know, maybe they're not doing it right. Or maybe it's just something that you don't get to occasionally sexually. It's all right. It's all okay. What's wrong with real? Well, you learned a long time ago that if the other person thinks you're having an orgasm, they're going to come back for more. Because there's something about that power that ignites other people. All right. It's one way to live. But maybe it's more than just not wanting to hurt their feelings. Maybe the other reason we don't want to tell the truth about ourselves is because of what happens when they feel hurt. Maybe we don't want to deal with the consequences, you know? But you have to. You have to take the consequences on full force and deal with them directly before you'll ever feel like a true adult. We're going to take a short break, play you a little music, and when we come back, we'll continue with our discussion.
I'm so tired. My mind is on the blink. I wonder, should I get up and fix myself a drink? No, no, no. I'm so tired. I don't know what to do. I'm so tired. My mind is set on you. I wonder, should I call you? But I know what you would do. And curse Sir Walter Raleigh, he was such a stupid get.
You'd say, wouldn't you want, but it's no joke. It's doing me harm, you know I can't sleep. I can't stop my brain, you know, 3 weeks. I'm going insane, you know, I'd give you everything I've got for little peace of mind. I'd give you everything.
This is listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, bringing you news, information, and programming meant to empower you. We need your support. If you go to our website, wbai.org, and press the donate button, for as little as $10 a month, you can become a sustaining member. You'll be making a tax-deductible contribution that helps us help you by bringing you Truth in Radio.
About risk. The mind is a coward. For those who listen to it become utterly cowardly. The mind is not adventurer. It is very cautious. It takes every step with thinking and calculation until it is certain that there is no risk. Until it has seen others taking the risk. Until it has seen others taking the step, and there has been no danger. Hence, listening to the mind is the most disturbing phenomena of growth. When everything is going good, the mind comes in and says, "Watch out." Because you listen to the mind's fears, you stop living. The mind would keep you always the same, never taking risks. Newness is an enemy to the mind. Sameness is its friend. The dilemma. To laugh is to risk appearing a fool. To weep is to risk appearing sentimental. To reach out is to risk involvement. To expose feelings is to risk rejection. To place your dreams before the crowd is to risk ridicule. To love is to risk not being loved in return. To go forward in the face of overwhelming odds is to risk failure. But risks must be taken, because the greatest hazard of life is to risk nothing. The person who risks nothing, does nothing, has nothing, is nothing. You may avoid suffering and sorrow, but you cannot learn, feel, change, grow, or love. Chained by certitudes, you are only a slave. Only the person who risks is free.
Thievery Corporation. Castillo.
This is Armand Mill with you at the Positive Mind, WBAI, 99.5 FM on your dial. The subject is blame, B-L-A-M-E. Blame. It's the single most self-defeating behavior I could think of. I'm talking about people who blame other people for the misery in their lives. Are you one of them? Probably not if you tune into this program, since the idea of this show is for you to learn more about yourself. Since our whole raison d'etre, reason for being here, is that introspection rather than extrospection. Extrospection means you look on the outside for the cause of everything. I guess if you really need a word, we are inspectors. And since we do our looking inward alone, we are private inspectors. Isn't that cute? Me, I like the name that a caller gave me. She called me psychodetective. So let the private inspectors and the psychodetective put our minds together on this one. The issue is blame. What's it about? How can somebody really think it's always somebody else's fault? Why would people continue to blame someone else when they must know that they play a part in the drama? I'm talking about people who blame others for their misfortune, who blame others for what they feel. I mean, the idea that somebody can make you feel something comes from a thing called magical thinking. Magical thinking is what happens to children. When you're a child and you're living in a world and one day you have crayons and you're drawing on a wall, your mother may walk in and say, "Look at what you've done, you've given me a headache." Now you're a child, 2 years old, 3 years old, and you figure with this crayon, you've given mom a headache. And imagine how confusing that must be. But your mother says that she feels a headache because of you. So what do? You don't want your mother to have a headache, so you take some piece of paper and you try to wipe it off the wall, and she looks at it again, and she says, "Now look at what you've done, you've just made it worse." And her headache gets worse. Now you've learned two things. You have a power to hurt somebody with a behavior of yours, on one hand. And on the other hand, once you use it, you can't undo it. So blame is something that we do with ourselves, and it's something we learn to do to someone else. Why is it so important to ascribe fault? Why does a parent have to turn to a child and blame the child for the way they feel? We're looking about the accusers. J'accuse, the finger pointers, the blamers. It's your fault, people. The people that could run you ragged defending yourself. You know any blamers? I'll bet you do. Did you ever get in a position where somebody is blaming you for something and you start defending yourself? You try to explain. First, they ask you a simple question. Did you go ba-ba-da-da-ba-ba? And you go, well, ba-ba-da-ba. And then you start defending yourself, and then it comes more and more like an accusation, and the finger starts to get pointed at you. And you get this feeling that you're sinking and you're fighting off, you're warding off the blows. How did this happen? How did you get into this situation? New Age introspectors are great for blamers. One has the integrity to always look at their part of the action, and the other, the blamer, always accuses. So it keeps we inspectors busy. Maybe that's why we tend to team up with each other. Living with a blamer is like living with a therapist. They're always giving you food for thought, fodder for the mind. Or maybe the reason people who are not blamers team up with blamers is because they're intrinsically guilt-ridden about something, so they get someone out of defending themselves constantly. If you have some guilt that you're walking around with, such as having wounded your mother, maybe you need to find somebody who's going to spend their life blaming you. Me, I learned a long time ago that if someone is angry with me and takes no responsibility whatsoever for whatever is going on, I won't feed the conversation. In fact, I tell them, if you can't look at your part of this, even to consider how you played a role in it, I won't continue the conversation. I just won't. I won't sit there and just listen to someone if they accuse me. You can usually tell by the number of times the word you is used in a conversation. And here's the way it usually works. You, dabba 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 dabba, you went down to the store, and then you, and the word you starts sounding like it's just repeated over and over again, and the word I doesn't exist. So the person's talking to you, and they're saying, you did this, and you did that, and you did this, and they repeat sequences, but the word I is invisible. That's a good clue for you to get out of the conversation. Now, I'm not that tough, because one thing I know for sure, if I love somebody and they start yelling accusations at me, I don't see just my defensiveness. I see their desperation. I see the frustration and helplessness that they must feel behind this blame. Sometimes, if I'm not tense myself, I can dip down to my loving self and deal with the other person as a parent looking at a child in pain. But mostly, in my personal life, I won't be a part of it. In my professional life, that's a different story. As a therapist, counselor, consultant, I always hear couples coming in blaming each other. Every couple that ever comes to see me usually comes to me with one desire. Please tell him or please tell her that they're wrong. They come to see me that whatever they do with each other doesn't really work. That's why they're coming to me in the first place. But what they do is they want me to take sides with one of them that the other one is wrong. So a man will walk in with his wife, and she'll walk in with him, and she'll say to him, she'll kind of feed him, and then he'll get angry, and then she'll point and say, see, that's the behavior. That's the reason we're here, or vice versa. So at first I watch them do their thing, blame each other, then I try to cut through the web and get each of them to see their parts in it. That's the only way that couples can resolve their difficulties. But when I see the blamer, I see a frustrated, helpless child. And since I'm not the one being accused, I can stay in there with compassion and understanding. But when you're being accused, when the finger's being pointed at you, it's very hard to keep your mind. A blamer is like a screamer. Often they come in the same package. Now, I did a series of programs on hysterical outbursts and rage. And these programs go into depth about people who scream and tend to yell. We can always search those through the archive, but if you have somebody who is a blamer, they're just like the screamers. They're frustrated, unhappy people who tend to feel helpless in the world. Now, this helplessness is very important, especially if you love someone who has a tendency to blame you for what they feel. So, item number one. Blamers often feel helpless and powerless in the world. People who fall in love with blamers somewhere enjoy the helplessness and the powerlessness of the other person. We just hate the blaming part. But if you're kind, if you're the kind of person who is effective and feels powerful in the world somewhat, you very often find helpless people attractive. It gives you something to do, something to take care of, places to exercise all that power. So first lesson, blamers, people who tend to blame other people for everything are powerless, helpless people. And if you see it that way, when they're blaming, you don't see this big person beating up this child, you. You see the child who's really frustrated. When you see it and you wonder, why am I with this person? Because you're probably attracted to that powerlessness of the blaming person. That's a big bit of information. Blamers grew up in a world of complainers. The word blame comes from the French word blâme, which comes from the Latin word plame, which comes from the Celtic word plane, which means to accuse. So to complain is to accuse altogether. I made that all up, actually. It's not true. Blame doesn't come from blame, doesn't come from the Celtic, I don't know. They're just being creative. But I'm sure somewhere complain must mean to blame together. Complain. That's what complaining is, an attempt to engage somebody else in your blaming. Isn't it fun to get together and both of you blaming somebody else for something wrong? So lesson number three is that blamers come from complainers. It's like when they were children, there was this importance put on who made anything happen. Who did that? The parents of families of blamers were punishers. In one form or another, it was critically important to find out whose fault it was for anything that went wrong. And they were always finding who did it. Whose fault is it? You know that feeling when somebody's looking to find the guilty person and you may be the guilty person and you're trying to hide at the same time and you're just keeping your mouth shut? You know that feeling? Do you know it? If you don't know it, then you didn't grow up. Maybe you didn't grow up at all. Everybody is guilty about something. I remember one patient who tells a story of a fight he was having where he was badly beaten. He was 8 years old. He goes home and chipped and broken teeth, bleeding, and his ribs was cracked. His father's first response was to determine whose fault it was, who started the fight. He was bleeding. He was hurting. He needed his daddy to hold him and take care of him, but daddy wanted to know whose fault it was. See what I mean about helplessness? What really happened is that when the boy got home so badly hurt, the father felt helpless and probably had a flash of guilt for not being there to protect his son. He probably felt bad for his son. What did he do instead? He blamed his son. So the real compulsion the father felt when asking his son whose fault it was to convince himself that it wasn't his. And this little slip into neurotic response on the father's part left an indelible mark on the boy's mind. He remembered saying to himself, if you're hurt, really hurt, don't look for anybody to help you, because nobody will. No wonder he grew up as a recluse and depressed. Blamers of children are dangerous. So lesson number three, blamers beget blamers. And you take it one step further for those of you who have just spent the time with your families over the summer. If you win families of blamers, if you're not or choose not to be a blamer yourself, when you get together with your family who does but complain or blame, you feel alienated, you feel separated and certainly lonely. A family function where people are sitting around being critical of somebody at some other level or blaming somebody else is very tough if you don't participate. Because blamers and complainers don't really make contact. And if you've gotten to the point, like most of my listeners, where you've done a little work on yourself, you don't join in the family festivity of complaining. That makes you feel really alone in a crowd. That's what makes people so depressed and weird after their family visits. They were there, but they were lonely. Nobody held them. Nobody embraced them. And people were just sitting there being negative. By the way, when's the last time somebody held you? Just held you for 5 minutes or more, without sex, without talking, just held you. People forget to do it. They get a 30-second hug on New Year's, but 5 minutes means a lot. We're dealing with this whole issue of blame. We're talking about people of the blame, people who blame other people for what they feel and how their life is. We've gone through some of the causes. People who blame are afraid of their true feelings. Now, this seems strange because blamers are usually very emotional. They're very emotional people who are very often afraid of their true feelings. They are comfortable with anger and rage, but anger and rage are usually cover-ups for other feelings like helplessness, powerlessness, loneliness, and sadness. So blamers make other people responsible for what they feel. They even say it, "You made me angry. You made me jealous." How can anybody make anybody feel anything? You made me love you. I didn't want to do it. So if you listen, part of the accusation is ascribing the feelings to you or someone else. Blamers can cry, but not because they realize that they've lost something like the reason most people cry, but they cry out of frustration because you won't let them have what they want. Lesson number five, blamers lack a clear, strong sense of themselves. Clearly, they identify themselves by their reaction to other people. A very interesting experiment is one that I do with clients when I ask them to describe what they feel in their bodies. If I were to ask you, what do you feel right now in your body, just your sensations, And if I were to ask you to describe it by saying, just describe a sensation, I feel hot, I feel cold, I feel tense, I feel loose, I feel in, and then put that with a part of your body, in my right leg. So I feel tightness in my right calf. That's talking about what you feel in your body. I feel, and now if you were to ask somebody to give you a complete inventory of what they feel, you know, it's an endless amount of sensations you could feel on the inside, even though you think you can't. You can. One of the things that happens is they begin feeling is that they can only relate to the negative feelings that they have. I feel pain in this part of my body and pain in that part. I feel a tension, a stress. People will rarely tell you about a good feeling that they have. So in other words, people are very often identified by the pain that they feel. That's what makes them know they're alive. Now, it's kind of the same way with blamers. It's someone who is feeling alive by blaming other people. It's the negativity. I feel sad when meeting somebody for the first time and I hear them talking badly about someone else. It's amazing that this person, who's usually trying to win my approval, decides that the way to do it is to talk badly about someone else. A very wise man who I met when I was, very young, said to me, "Armand, please don't ever think that you will stand taller if you stand on somebody else's body." And it stuck with me. When I hear somebody talking badly about someone else, as soon as I hear that, I realize that I would never choose this person as a friend or even a professional associate. I wouldn't even let them work with me. People of the blame are people who I cannot trust. I can't trust their integrity. I feel sorry for them because I know that they're alienated from themselves. You see, they're usually critical of people who possess the very same characteristics they do. We tend to judge the things in other people that lay dormant inside us, that we dislike so much and it's hidden from our view. So the things that we are most critical about in other people is probably some aspect of ourselves. Remember that saying, when you point your finger at someone, there are four more fingers on your hand pointing at yourself. It's true. Blamers have a really tough time out there. Nobody tells them the truth because they are so reactive and accusatory. Nobody gets really close to them because they really don't trust the blamer. Nobody really loves them. Now, you may take exception to that statement because you know you love someone who is a blamer, and I said really loves. Loves in a way that can be felt. Blamers never feel really safe, and no one around them ever feels really safe, and therefore, if there is no atmosphere of safety, love is very questionable. So don't blame me for bringing this all up to you. I hope it's useful information. We're going to have to be going right now, my friends. If you wanted to hear today's program again, you can go to WBAI.org or you can go to thepositivemind.com, where you will hear a lot of archives. And you could send an email also to Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D, at thepositivemind.com. I'd love to hear from you and hear your reactions. Be back with you soon, my friends.